Wilson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Jack Wilson. I'm representing the petitioner appellant in this case, Mr. Bruce Brown. This case is obviously raises similar issues to the case just argued, McGee v. Bartow, with a couple of additional issues of procedural default. Mr. Brown has been under an order of indefinite civil commitment for the past decade by the state of Wisconsin, based on what can only be called junk, unreliable psychiatry. The state seeks to justify Mr. Brown's detention based on two diagnoses made by its employee, Dr. Dennis Doran, whose job is to testify in these proceedings against individuals and on behalf of the state. The first diagnosis that was touched on some in the first argument today, Dr. Doran refers to it as paraphilia not otherwise specified, non-consent. This diagnosis has been rejected by the authors of the DSM. It's been rejected by the American Psychiatric Association. It's basically been rejected by the profession as a whole.
Rejected in the sense it was proposed, but then not accepted as part of it.
Correct, and it was voted down by the American Psychiatric Association General Assembly, and it's basically because I think as Mr. Schwab said, it's too unreliable to be reliably diagnosed. There are too many reasons that rapes happen.
Wasn't some of the opposition also people who were concerned that it would be used as a defense, an insanity defense, if it reached the status of a DSM-4 category?
There was some opposition on that basis, Your Honor. And I think two things to note about that are that first, another reason for rejecting it was the diagnostic reliability. And I believe the literature says that was really the primary reason for rejecting it.
It actually comes down to a vote, doesn't it? Just a raw vote at some point.
It does come down to a raw vote, and
it's hard. It's kind of like legislation in a sense. It's hard to know exactly the reasons the voters voted.
That is true. You know, we have to rely on reports of it.
But certainly, it is true. There is a bunch of literature that criticizes it as a diagnosis.
That is definitely true. There is a lot of – this isn't just the APA's position. This isn't just the DSM's rejection. There are a lot of scholarly academic articles criticizing this diagnosis. The second point, I guess, about it –
But there are some that support it, aren't there?
You know, the state cited a couple of articles in its brief as supportive of this diagnosis. The first, they use the quote, widespread acceptance. Now, if you go look at the article, the article is absolutely against the state. It says this is a bogus diagnosis. And when it says widespread acceptance, what it's referring to is state forensic examiners. It's saying it's gained widespread acceptance among people who testify for the state in these proceedings. And we don't deny that. We think they use this diagnosis all the time. And I think there are studies that show this, that this diagnosis and the second diagnosis that are at issue in this case are extremely popular diagnoses. And
well, like anything in this, where you have to take a vote, it's subject to some extent to special interests, whether it be the state or the other side, right?
That's true, Your Honor. You're referring back to the DSM's rejection of this. It is true. Special interests are involved, I suppose. The criticism that this was rejected in part because, you know, I guess special interests didn't want it to be asserted as a defense in criminal proceedings. It's interesting because I guess the argument there is that it doesn't rise to the sort of volitional level that should make it a defense in a criminal proceeding. And the standard here in civil commitment proceedings is very similar to the insanity standard in criminal proceedings. So I'm not really sure which way that cuts if there was opposition to it on the ground that it shouldn't be a defense in criminal proceedings. And so I think, you know, in Hendricks and in Crane, the court has consistently stressed that the diagnoses in those cases were diagnoses that the psychiatric profession itself classified as a serious medical or a serious disorder. And in Justice Kennedy's concurring opinion in Hendricks, which was the crucial fifth vote in that case, he said specifically this diagnosis is at least described by the DSM. You don't have that here. This is a diagnosis that is not recognized by the mainstream psychiatric profession. It's not in the DSM, and there is just an abundance of scholarly literature saying this is a diagnostically unreliable diagnosis.
But paraphilia NOS is a sort of a category, or it's a catch-all, and it's not limited to the specific examples.
Absolutely, Your Honor. It is a category, and it is not limited to those specific examples. And I think that is probably the primary basis of the district court's opinion in this case. The reason that that doesn't work is that we have a situation here where Dr. Doran knows that this diagnosis was rejected by the DSM, and he's now attempting to write it back into the DSM through these through this not otherwise specified category. The DSM says that the not otherwise specified category should be used for diagnoses that are less frequently encountered than the diagnoses that are specifically listed in the DSM. That's not the case here. This diagnosis, you know, I think as the experience in these SVP trials shows, is made all the time. It is not comparable to the specifically listed, not otherwise specified diagnoses. If you look at those are very unusual disorders that involve corpses or obscene phone calls, things among that nature. This, if you accept this diagnosis, this is not an infrequently encountered diagnosis. This is something that, you know, Dr. Doran would and colleagues would diagnose all the time.
Well, there aren't a lot of these cases. I mean, I know there are hundreds in Wisconsin, but not thousands. There are many, many more rape convictions and sexual violence convictions than SVP proceedings.
That is true. I would still say, Your Honor, that this diagnosis, paraphilia NOS non-consent, is not comparable to the other specifically listed paraphilia NOS examples that are given. And another point I think that's made about those is not only are they generally infrequently encountered diagnoses, they are inherently sort of nonviolent diagnoses, the disorders that are listed there. And so, I mean, I think when you look at it, when you step back and look at it as a whole, what Dr. Doran has done here is knowing that this diagnosis has been rejected by the DSM, he has nonetheless attempted to write it back into the DSM through a category that is really, the category is sort of fundamentally inconsistent with the diagnosis he's making. It's also interesting that I guess at the same time, the state is arguing that it really doesn't matter if it's in the DSM, but at the same time, Dr. Doran is obviously acknowledging that the DSM has some professional standing and some credence to it because he's attempting to use that, albeit I would say without any real basis, he's attempting to use it to give credence to his diagnosis. I'd like to move on, I guess, to the second diagnosis at issue in this case.
Just before you do, though, in terms of our standard of review, you're here really seeking relief for what you contend is a fundamental miscarriage of justice. Isn't that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
You would agree that there was a procedural default, and that's really your only way around that.
I agree that there was a procedural default, that this wasn't raised in state court. I think that there are two ways around it. One is the fundamental miscarriage of justice, and one is I believe that his state appellate counsel was ineffective, at least for failing to raise these issues, and that should constitute a cause for the procedural default.
But you didn't raise that in state court. Your client did.
That was not raised in state court either. And so the issue that comes down to is whether the state has asserted that my client should have filed a petition under. It's called a state versus Knight petition.
Like the fellow just before you had.
Right, what he did. And our contention, Your Honor, I would submit that is not the sort of regularly followed and state procedure that can give rise to a procedural default. If you look at the state versus Knight opinion, it says over and over that this Knight petition procedure is about criminal defendants, and that's the sole issue before the court, I think, is the language. And I've researched this, and I've been able to turn up only the one Knight petition filed by Mr. McGee and one other case that references a Knight petition being filed in a civil commitment case. So it's not at all clear. The courts haven't spoken with clarity that is something that a civil commitment petitioner should do. It's been infrequently followed. I don't think it put Mr. Brown on notice that that's what he needed to do to preserve this claim. Turning back to the miscarriage of justice standard, one thing that's different, I think, about this case than the ordinary miscarriage of justice case is that in a lot of criminal cases, of course, you can look at the record and say, even if the constitutional claim has merit, the miscarriage of justice standard isn't going to be satisfied. Here, I think the state has correctly conceded that if both of these diagnoses are invalid, there's obviously been a miscarriage of justice. And so in this case, you actually have to get to the merits in order to decide the miscarriage of justice claim.
The diagnosis testified to in Wisconsin, I gather, can be by psychologists as well as psychiatrists.
I think it appears to me that it can be testified to by just about anyone. I think, as Mr. Schwab said in his case, he had a urban studies PhD, and I think a former rape counselor who was testifying in that case. So I don't think there's really, and I think as we've explained in our brief, Wisconsin doesn't place a whole lot of limits on expert testimony. I think it's sort of explicitly anything goes. The antisocial personality disorder, I'll address quickly. I think if you look back at the chronology of the Supreme Court's cases in this area, you start out with Fuchsia, where the issue there was antisocial personality disorder and dangerousness, and the court ends up saying that's not enough. The state says that there's some ambiguity in that case, but I think that the best reading of that case is that antisocial personality disorder plus a finding of dangerousness isn't enough. You look forward to the Hendricks case, in which Justice Kennedy says disorders may be too imprecise. I think in our brief, we set out why the criteria for antisocial personality disorder can just meet millions of people, 80% of the prison population. They're not at all imprecise. The court in Crane has an oblique reference to antisocial personality disorder where they imply, I think, the best reading of that is that it doesn't distinguish the typical recidivist, and that's absolutely the case. It describes the typical recidivist. It doesn't do anything to distinguish the typical recidivist. And so I can see I'm into my rebuttal time now. I would like to save a few minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. O'Neill.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Aaron O'Neill from the Wisconsin Department of Justice, appearing for the appellee, Stephen Waters. The issue in this case is whether Mr. Brown has excused the procedural defaults of his claims that the medical diagnoses on which his civil commitment is based, as a sexually violent person are based, do not satisfy due process, one, because he's challenging the paraphilia non-consent diagnosis as unrecognized by the psychiatric community, and the other, antisocial personality disorder, as being too imprecise. There is no dispute between the parties that Mr. Brown procedurally defaulted these claims and that, therefore, he has to show either cause and prejudice or that a fundamental miscarriage of justice will result from his commitment if the court does not address his claims. Briefly, on the cause and prejudice issue, as this court already has discussed, Mr. Brown's asserting that his trial counsel and his appellate counsel were ineffective for not asserting these claims in state court, but Mr. Brown has never asserted that his trial counsel and his appellate counsel were ineffective in state court, and under Edwards versus Carpenter, unless he can show cause and prejudice for not raising those claims, that cannot serve as a basis to excuse his default. I think the crux of this appeal really gets to the fundamental miscarriage of justice standard, and whether Mr. Brown can satisfy that. And that, in turn, gets to the merits of his arguments. The parties agree that under the fundamental miscarriage of justice standard, as it should apply to civil commitment proceedings, Mr. Brown has to show that it's more likely than not that no reasonable juror or fact finder, as the case may be, a lot of cases, civil commitment cases are tried to judges in Wisconsin, but no reasonable fact finder would have found him to be a sexually violent person under the applicable statutes under Chapter 980. It's the state's position that under this standard, Mr. Brown has to show that both of the diagnoses which he challenges violate due process in order to be entitled to relief. And that is because the standard being that no reasonable juror could find him eligible for civil commitment if one diagnosis is in fact valid, a reasonable juror could find him eligible for commitment. Getting to the diagnoses themselves, specifically first with the non-consent diagnosis, I think Mr. Brown perhaps overstates the nature of the diagnosis. I think it's sort of suggested that Dr. Doran, in his case, you know, just sort of made this up out of whole cloth. And if you read Dr. Doran's book, for example, there is a recitation of the history of this diagnosis. It's not a new concept, and for the reasons that have already been discussed today, with concern to people using it, for example, as an insanity defense or otherwise just using it to excuse sexually assaultive behavior. This idea is that people can have a deviant sexual arousal to non-consensual sex has been around for a while. And what Dr. Doran did in his book and when he evaluated Mr. Brown was he came up with a set of criteria to attempt to measure the non-consent diagnosis, criteria that appear for other diagnoses in the DSM. And he did that because he was concerned that this diagnosis of paraphilia, not otherwise specified non-consent, was being overdiagnosed by sexual predator evaluators. And he wanted to provide them with criteria by which to judge this diagnosis. The state has to concede that this diagnosis does not appear specifically in the DSM, and that it has been criticized by the American Psychiatric Association. But as the court pointed out in the Supreme Court pointed out in Hendricks, exact congruity with the Psychiatric Association, American Psychiatric Association medical standards, is the DSM is not required. The states are allowed to use their own judgment in defining terms relating to mental conditions that, you know, have significance. And even if you look at both in Hendricks, the dissent, and the majority opinion, they both recognize this. I believe in the dissent, Justice Breyer says, you know, there's debate in the medical community, and the state can choose a reasonable position within that debate and define its statutes accordingly. The court even recognizes in Hendricks that the diagnosis that was at issue there, which is pedophilia,
You defined your statute accordingly?
Well, based on...
All you've said is there needs to be a mental disease, defect, something of a medical nature mm-hmm. that does cause involuntary sexual violence. Right?
It makes it more likely that the person will commit sexual violence,
yes. So what does that have to do with the state's adoption of these amorphous diagnoses as fulfilling the first part of that? I mean, those are just court decisions that have arisen. We have no indication that the legislature of Wisconsin thinks it's a good idea to put commit people on this basis, do we? It doesn't really speak to
the statute defines a mental disorder colleague said earlier, a cognitive or volitional disorder, and whether that disorder exists is a matter for the jury to resolve based on the testimony presented at the commitment trial.
The state statute really is non-responsive to the issue in front of us, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, it doesn't, you know, say the diagnosis has to be of this nature or anything. It is fairly wide open. If you look at in Hendricks, though, I think Mr. Brown has clearly demonstrated that the non-consent diagnosis is subject to debate in the psychiatric community. And as Hendricks noted, the diagnosis there, pedophilia, is also subject to debate whether that constitutes a mental illness in the psychiatric community. And really what Hendricks stands for is the uncertain and dynamic nature of psychiatric diagnosis and how it changes and how new data comes to light really has to give the state flexibility in defining their statutes that have mental health issues involved with them. Briefly, with respect to Mr. Brown's antisocial personality disorder diagnosis, his claim is that this is too imprecise, that, you know, a great number of prisoners could be diagnosed with this disorder. But that really is not the question. As this court explained in its decision in Adams, it's not just antisocial personality disorder on which a person can be committed. That antisocial personality disorder has to make the person dangerous, as it's defined in the statute. in other words, the antisocial personality disorder has to make the person make it reasonably probable that they will commit future acts of sexual violence. Merely having APD, which, as we acknowledge, most of the prison population has, and a great number of the non-prison population has, it would not make you eligible to commit for commitment. The state could not just go rounding up people who have antisocial personality disorder and involuntarily commit them. If there are no other questions from the court, I'd ask you to affirm the judgment and order of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Wilson. You have 3 minutes, Mr. Wilson.
First, Your Honor, on the non-consent diagnosis, the state's position here is that it just doesn't really matter that the DSM has rejected this and that the American Psychiatric Profession has association has rejected it. I think the best reading of Hendricks and Crone is that that's just not the case. And so that's really the dispute here, is whether that matters. I want to say that I'm not advocating here a strict rule that it has to be in the DSM in order for it to be a valid basis for constitutional commitment. What I am saying is that it has to be a diagnostically valid disorder. And right now, standing here, the DSM is by far the best indicia that we have of what is a valid disorder. This is not, and I think as counsel said, this is not a new diagnosis. This is not some emerging minority viewpoint in the profession that has materialized since the last version of the DSM. This is something that's been around 20 years, and it's failed to gain any real acceptance thus far.
But there is the underlying, I mean, this really doesn't apply to your argument. I probably shouldn't raise it. But the fact is that there are concerned groups with regard to women's groups and men as well who want to put sexual predators away, whether either criminally or civilly. And that kind of pressure goes into this DSM in a number of ways, right?
I'm not completely familiar with the DSM drafting process. I can assume that interest groups do pressure the drafting process. What I would say is I guess if there are those sorts of pressures, you would expect to see this get included as a basis for a sounder basis.
But they are professional things, and I mean, so they have to take it in a sense of looking at it in a professional way too, and not try to avoid the things that are just politically correct or politically popular at a particular time, right?
That may be the case, Your Honor.
You don't have to answer that question. That was an observation.
With respect to the APD diagnosis, our position is that the diagnosis itself has to do some of the work of distinguishing the typical recidivist from the average sex offender. And the state is putting all of its eggs sort of in the basket of this additional finding of dangerousness. And I think if you read the Hendricks and Crane opinions, the court makes clear that the first step, the diagnosis, has to do some of the work. And in this case, it's just, study after study has shown that 70 or 80% of the prison population has antisocial personality disorder, that it's defined by the conduct, the past conduct of the individual, rather than any sort of underlying emotional or mental disturbance. And so it's really just, it's tautological. They're past criminal conduct, and therefore you have antisocial personality disorder. And so I would submit that it's not doing any of the work on as far as distinguishing the typical recidivist. And I see that I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson, for taking this case and your firm as well. Appreciate it. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.